You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It's August 17th, 2023 at 7:35 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And I was thinking that I would talk a little bit about the patterns of relationships that form based on attachment conditioning, and also about slow dating, or as we like to say it, dating like you're a secure person, even if you're not yet. And then I'll try to tie this into the ideas of meditation and how one examines that. We often talk about the developing of a social network as a preliminary practice, so that you then have this group of people or this network that you can rely on, so that when you want to do deep practice, you have the support that you need to in order to be able to do it consistently. If you don't have a strong social support, then if you get into trouble in your practice, which is easy enough, you can just delay or put off the practice. And then you'll notice the pattern of starts and stops with practice that tend to come with that kind of organization. When I say you get into trouble with your practice, what I mean is that you hear some protections that you have in place, and then have experiences of a self and world that are hard to manage sometimes. We could reflect on that through the attachment lens. One of the things that's characteristic of a secure attachment is an ease of the experience of self. So this is largely an internal experience where the your perception of the things that are happening are included in your self-awareness. But it's also possible that you can filter out a lot of the material that might be useful to you to know. As an example of that, dismissing people have a tendency to filter out awareness of emotion, so they don't feel it in their body, and sometimes they don't even aren't even cognitively aware of it. Preoccupied people don't monitor things, so they get involved in reactive, spontaneous behavior, and they don't really pay attention to how it lands on other people. They just pay attention to whether they're getting what they want. And they can easily trample the boundaries of other people. And so other people respond by making the boundaries more and more rigid. And because they're not monitoring or paying attention to it, it isn't until the boundaries are absolutely solid and inflexible that they begin to notice it. And often by then, it's too late to repair the relationship. They notice that they've violated the other person's boundaries, and the other person is already leaving. And it's confusing to them why that happened. They don't really have a sense of it because they didn't see or experience the many protests that happen on the way to that happening. So what's useful in terms of meditation practice is beginning to understand the nature of conceptual reality, the way that you created it, and constantly be comparing it to the ultimate reality experience. The Pali word for that is taja panati, which means, taja means the looking back, and panati means conceptual reality. So looking back on conceptual reality from the point of view of ultimate reality to see if what you're creating moment by moment is actually what's happening, or that it is some way limited or distorted by the way that you create it. Of course, you create a sense of yourself, you create a sense of other people. And because the creation of self and the creation of other people is dependent on the conditions of the present moment, on the conditions of the mind and how you create it, we want to be paying attention. It's constantly, I like to think of it as a rocking back and forth. We rock into the conceptual reality we've made, and then we rock back into the sensing data to see whether or not what we've made is actually an accurate representation. Secure functioning relationships are meant to be supportive of your exploration. And we do grow up in a society where there's a mythology around relationships being the central source of meaning. And that can be problematic because they don't really do that. Really great functioning relationships support you and encourage you. We might even say push you into exploring and discovering the things that you need to know. So they push you out into the world so that you can find out what you need to know. And then when you come rushing back, they're interested in what you found out. So we talk about, I talk about that in terms of good traveling companions. You surround yourself with people who are interested in enough in the things that you find interesting so that they resonate with the discoveries that you make. And do you find the things that they're exploring and are interesting in resonant enough that you're interested in what they find out, and that what they find out can be useful to you, and what you find out can be useful to them, so that it creates a synergistic relationship. What is it like when somebody's excited about the things that you find out and are curious about what you discovered? And can you contrast that to what it's like to try and express that to somebody who's uninterested in the things that you find out, or uninterested in the areas of exploration that you're engaged in? This goes all the way back to this core experience, this beginning experience with caregivers. We don't really know much when we're born. Nothing is really defined for us. And our survival is dependent on the care that we receive. When we experience the care, it's usually at the hands of somebody who's providing the care to us. If we grow up in an intact family system, of course, it's somebody who chose to have us and chose to be responsible for our care. There's a lot of motivations for why people have children, which often don't include the needs of the child. But if you lucked out and actually you were a wanted child, they were excited about your arrival. Still, the main way that we understand who we are and what our qualities are is in the reflection of the in the face of the caregiver, of their experience of us. Did you grow up in a home with a resourced caregiver who was able to provide for you without so much stress that it debilitated them? Did they find the energy to care for you and to be delighted in the way that you were, and to encourage you along the way to develop? One of the key things about raising children, of course, is that you assess their capabilities and you keep moving the goalposts so that they have to strive to get things done, but you want to move it so that they can reach it and they have a sense of success in doing, a sense of confidence that they can do it, a sense of capability in doing it, and not to the point where they keep failing over and over again, so that they lose confidence, they lose a sense of capacity, of safety. But if you're not moving the goalpost, that is to say, if your caregivers didn't move the goalpost for you, then you never strived for anything, you never reached for anything. And that, in some sense, suppresses your development, suppresses the sense of confidence that you have in what you can go for, all of this affects later in life, the capacity that you have to understand what's meaningful and then to pursue those things. Life is difficult, even for those of us who are so privileged, it's still difficult. If you're lucky enough to have grown up with resources and to develop capacities that you can then gather resources for yourself, and that you can then use those resources to explore, that's very different than growing up in desperate environments where there's not enough and where you never get beyond simply surviving, so that the exploration is restricted. So if you had a caregiver who thought you were delightful and encouraged you to pursue the things that were interesting to you, then you probably can explore pretty well. And if you didn't have a caregiver who did that, then you have the limitations that were developed in or imposed on you in the circumstances of your childhood. Were you colicky and didn't sleep much? And did you wear out your caregivers to the point that they were overwhelmed by that experience? And so that they felt each of your demands as an intrusion and reflected back to you that you were demanding, that you were too needy, that you were never satisfied, and that that was the sense of self that you developed. One of the things that happens in practice is that we begin to understand that the nature of self is insubstantial, and that these arisings of conditioned responses to stimulus creates these versions or these concepts of reality, which may or may not be an accurate reflection. And so we need to pull these experiences apart and touch into what our actual capacities are, what our actual interests are, and how we might satisfy that. But it takes a while to really understand that when we create reality, it is based on this perceptual database that has developed since the very beginning of our lives, and it's woven into everything. Those early conceptions of self are woven into everything. And they can be completely convincing, particularly the ones that begin before autobiographical memory, before the sense of conscious self happens. Then a lot of those are just how it's always been. And there's no investigation or almost no awareness that that's the basis of the creation of the experience that you have. If you had an early experience where your preferences matter, where you had a sense that you were delightful to your caregivers, then woven in that fabric of the creation of conceptual reality is that you're delightful and that your needs can be met and that you're capable. And so you go about the world in a completely different way than somebody who has a feeling that they don't matter, that their preferences don't matter, that there's nothing out there for them. And neither one of those is necessarily an accurate reflection of what your capabilities are and what the conditions are. That's even something different from that. So the idea then is to move in the direction of building a social network that will support you so that you can push hard into your exploration. So we talk about the early attachment conditioning in the first 3 years of life. I find it fascinating. I was talking to Dean Dozier, who does our scoring for us, and with the advent of a lot of these spiritual practices that we have, past life regressions and rebirthing and all sorts of different ways of looking at early life, people are reporting these impressions of their early life as if they were actual memories. The adult attachment interview is a way of evaluating someone's attachment strategy. And I remember there's a question in it, which was, describe your early life with your caregivers as far back as you can remember in early childhood. And one of the people I was interviewing launched into how difficult it was in the womb, and that he had these vivid memories of his mother's difficulties outside of the womb and how it affected him in the womb. I tend to think of that as metaphor, but he was absolutely ardent that it was actual memories. From the neuroscience perspective, the autobiographical brain isn't the part of the brain that stores autobiographical memories isn't formed well enough. Christian?
I still remember when I was a glint in my dad's eye. seeing that world. I'm curious how...
What was your mother wearing in that moment?
I'm starting to dissociate at that question.
A slight variation on what was the face of your mother before you were born?
There you go. Now we can answer it. So I'm curious how that's received on the AI, or how Dean spoke about that.
Well, that's not that is we would consider that, I guess, a memory of the event of the process of doing it rather than an actual memory of early childhood. But if that makes sense, it's a loss of coherence in a way, but not a big one.
Okay, I guess that's what I was getting at. It seems maybe this is not a compassionate way to. It seems like a delusion a little bit, or I'm not sure how it could be useful for someone to think that way, but maybe that's
well, it depends on whether or not a belief like that is societally acceptable or not. And in the communities that he was in, that was a normal way of reflecting on the experience of life. It wasn't counter or outside of that. It's quite ordinary in doing an AAI, for instance, to ask somebody who later it turns out to be preoccupied to describe their earliest memories, and there's detailed memories of things that happened when they were one and two. But again, from a biological point of view, that's not possible because the brain isn't formed enough to store those memories. So then there might be a greater level of incoherence, or in the sense that they're not separating later memories from the earlier memories, or stories that they heard in the family from things that actually happened. But it's not a big coherence. It's not so surprising that you would remember something that you were told happened, and in the process of re-remembering it over time, drift from the understanding that this was clearly something that was told to you about what happened. And then as you activate the memory over and over again, inhabiting to the point that you would then begin to describe it as something that happened to you rather than something that was told to you happened. And, you know, because of the way that memory works and the way that we create it, what we're supposed to be doing is monitoring that so that the mind could easily present that something happened to you and then you recognize that, oh, actually, it didn't happen to me. It happened to a friend of mine, and I just took on that a story. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of doing that, but Shayla?
Is that quite common that we can pick up another person's memory and confuse it with our own?
It's kind of ordinary in the way that memory works. And that's why the mentalizing piece is so important. You really want to do track it. And, you know, the body mind is generating all of these memories, but the way that it generates memories is it takes the memory, the gists that are forming the memory, and the gists are these, it's like setting the levels in the body, in the different sense experiences in the body. You remember something, and what actually happens is that you have a replay of the experience, a little bit of visual, a little bit of auditory, a little bit of felt sense of the body, the same intensities of that you had in the moment that it was recorded. And then the imagination fills in the meaning to it. So it would be very easy for the imagination to make a mistake. And what we would be wanting to do is be continuously monitoring the spontaneous activations and then correcting it.
Yeah, and I remember you said once in one of your talks that as time goes on, we're actually, what we think we're remembering, but we're remembering the remembering the remembering.
Yeah.
When does our actual autobiographical capacity to remember, what age does it start happening?
For most people, it's 4, 5, 6. And then what you may notice a couple of memories that are earlier, and then the flow of memory starts. So I have a distinct memory of being 4. I have quite a lot of memories of being 4. But one in particular, I remember, and the reason I can age it is because my brother's in the memory and he was 5 and he remembers it really, or he remembered it really clearly, but I had only that one memory. And then there's a period of time that goes by that there isn't much, and then the memories begin again.
Oh.
So think back 4, 5, 6, that range, and or what is the early memory, and then when is there a bunch of memories that sort of are available? This only works if you're not strongly dismissing, because strongly dismissing people suppress emotion and as a result don't make memories of early childhood. Their memories don't really start until post-puberty, around 12.
Yeah, I've noticed that, and they often make up a whole lot about how great it was.
Oh, in childhood, yes. They don't have any actual memories to contradict the narrative.
That's right.
No evidence. That's not coherent, right? Mm. So when we talk about coherency, we're really talking about mapping onto Grice's maxims, Paul Grice. So quality, quantity, manner, and relevance. And quality means that you give an explanation that is complete, truthful, and that you present evidence that backs it up. And when the evidence is missing because you don't remember, then there's no way to know whether your version of it is true or not, and so that it's easy to drift into an ideal situation.
I don't know if I told you. Yeah, no, I think I told you that Gabor Mate,
uh-huh.
You know who he is.
Yeah.
He does this thing sometimes in person in front of a large audience. He'll say, "Is there anyone here who's really struggling like hell in their life and believes they had a great childhood?"
Uh-huh.
And then he says, "And if you're willing to come up here, I can disabuse you of that fantasy in less than 5 minutes." And he actually knows how to do it.
Oh, well, yeah. It's just, asking for evidence.
Yeah, it's fascinating to watch how quickly it can actually dissolve with skillful means.
It's a little worrisome that then the person's veil has been lifted, and then how did they cope?
That's right.
I did there when I was working in rehab. There, a young woman came in. She was 16, and she'd OD'd on fentanyl. And she said that she had a wonderful childhood, and their parents were amazing, caring people, and that she'd always gotten everything that she'd ever wanted. And so I said, well, this is the third time you've OD'd, nearly died, and you're in rehab. Can you make sense of that for me? And she said, I can't. There must be something wrong with me. So that there's a lot of ways that people defend against the knowledge of the childhood. And also because the dismissing person comes from neglect, there's an absence anyway. And how do you represent in the mind, in a child's mind, the absence of things? The disadvantages are quite profound. A child's brain is just a warren of unconnected axons. And so they just absorb an amazing amount of information because the brain is so adaptable to encode it. And then in puberty, the brain is stripped down to the barest scaffolding of the axons that are connected. So that if you grew up in a rich environment where, you know, your parents insisted that you tried every vegetable and every flavor, and they exposed you to a wide variety of cultures and everything that's available, you have this scaffolding to take in information as an adult. And if you had neglecting parents who put you in a barren environment and didn't do anything for you, that didn't feed you a variety of things, that didn't expand your interest, that then in that process of pruning down to the barest scaffolding, you have a very limited capacity to take on information in adult life. It really is a terrible consequence as you grow.
That's exactly the word I was going to say. And I wanted to ask you, George, because I know you spend so much time contemplating, researching, and living in the reality of what you just said, you know, which is like a well-meaning but insecure parent, like the impact that they have on the child and how it goes on, you know, yeah. The consequences, it can go on for generations. So how do you, like, I notice when I'm listening to you often, because you're so precise when you describe all this, and I just feel the pain of it.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how how you manage to stay equanimous.
Dan said you have to get good at having your heart broken, because otherwise you pull away from it. So that's what you do. You just let your heart be broken over and over again. It repairs right away, but you just let it be broken.
Wow. So, and how does it repair so quickly?
Because everything is impermanent, everything comes and goes, including the heartbreak coming and going. You just ride the wave of the heartbreak and it comes and goes. So I got the results of an AAI back to today, and there were six designations in the AAI, six letters in the describing the complexly disorganized attachment strategy. But I looked at that and my whole heart just collapsed, because I knew I know from doing this work how hard that person's life is. It's just heartbreaking to see it assessed in that way. And all of the stuff that's going to have to happen if he's going to be able to shift it. And then another one came back, and it was secure with features, which is also elating, right? In the sense that what needs to happen there is so manageable in a sense in comparison.
Yeah. Wow, George, thank you. I'm so glad I asked you that. It's a really powerful answer.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
If you understand and have the experience over and over again that your heart can break, but then it comes back together, you don't need to avoid it. You don't. We have the sense of avoiding pain because we think that we'll be overwhelmed by it. And yet, if you touch into this stuff and see that that actually isn't what happens, even if you are overwhelmed, it's temporary. You come back into balance.
Yeah, it feels like this, what you're saying right now, is a key, very key piece in your whole training on emotional regulation. Because a lot of people do get stuck. Like, I mean, I'm struggling with immense grief right now over the loss of my daughter. So that's why hearing what you're saying feels so powerful. Because I'm not having the experience of, you know, the heartbreak feels more severe than I've ever experienced it.
That's, so the grieving process is to take the attachment needs that you had with the lost person and intentionally move them to other people. Not the whole bundle, but each strand as it comes up. And the way that you can track this is that when you're in the experience of the present moment and it activates, part of that process of making the experience of the present moment is, who would I share it with? And when you notice the thought of the lost person coming into your mind, you then intentionally share it with somebody else. And then that begins to train the mind to move, to think of somebody else in patterns of experience like that. Now, when it's your daughter, the ties to the daughter are going to be vast. And so we create these buffers in the mind of, if only this had happened, if only that had happened, if only something different had happened, then I wouldn't be in this situation of the loss. And that actually is a productive thing, because it holds the overwhelming quality of so much loss. But then each time you notice the mind tending toward your, in this case, your daughter, you don't express to somebody else that you're caught up in the loss of your daughter. You look at the experience of the present moment and what you would likely have shared with her, and share that with somebody else. Is that making sense?
That is, wow. Yeah, I have had flashes of that. And you're giving me a kind of inspiration. And yeah, it's almost like an exploration on a certain level to keep going with that, because that's not a conventional understanding of what we need to do when we're grieving at all. That's, yeah.
Well, one of the things about, there's a lot of sadness, and a lot of that sadness needs to be shared. But what you'll notice in our culture is that people run out of bandwidth for the sadness long before the sadness is over. And so you have to manage the expression of it. But people aren't have bandwidth for the experience that caused the sense of loss to arise, and actually uprooting that and connecting it somewhere else. Gradually, what the mind does is reroute. And so when something like that happens, rather than the pattern creating the thought of the lost person, it creates the thought of the person that you can share it with now. And then eventually, when you've done enough of that, you don't think of the person who's lost so often. Some people have the idea that we should never forget them and hold on forever. But in a Buddhist frame, of course, everything is impermanent. And everything is lost. And so the idea...
I don't have that one, George.
What?
I don't have that belief that I've seen people get very fixated.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel particularly healthy to me. Yeah. Good. So, yeah, thank you.
So I said at the beginning that I would talk about the idea of how to manage dating or manage finding new relationships. If you don't already have enough relationships, then you're going to have to go out and get them. And then we frame it in a particular way. The first thing that you need to know from somebody else is, do they reliably emotionally regulate you? That's the most important thing. You're going to use them as a base to explore from, and in order to be able to go out into the world and get totally sideswiped and knocked crazy, be able to come rushing back and have somebody catch you, they have to be able to do it reliably. And emotional regulation is an unconscious autonomic process. They can't make a decision to do it. They just have to have a capability to match you well enough that they can do it. And so when you meet somebody and you're considering involving yourself with them, the first thing that you want to pay attention to is, do you feel consistently more regulated after spending a half hour with them or so? That's the idea. If you feel consistently regulated by them, we often say, do you feel better? Do you feel the same? Do you feel worse? It has to be you feel better. And spend a little bit of time figuring that out, because this is really the foundation of relationship. Then what you have to do is flip it around and find out from them whether they feel consistently regulated by you. Do they feel better? Do they feel the same? Do they feel worse? Only if they feel better consistently, that is to say that you regulate each other reliably, are they going to put enough energy into a relationship that it would make sense for you also to put enough energy into it, to form it into a relationship? You could have any combination. You could feel regulated, they could feel dysregulated. You could feel regulated, they could feel not that much. You could be tremendously regulating for them and they could be dysregulating for you or neutral for you. So that's why the match is important. The next thing, the third thing is, do you enjoy taking care of them enough that you would be happy to do it? Because if you don't enjoy taking care of them in the way that they need to be taken care of, you won't do enough of it and they won't feel taken care of. The relationship will not flourish. Then you need to find out from them whether they enjoy taking care of you in the way that you need to be taken care of. Because if they don't enjoy it, they won't do enough and you won't feel taken care of. Shayla?
Yeah, I have a question about that part, George.
Okay.
Stan Tatkin, who I know you have a lot of respect for his work.
Sure.
So he puts it a little differently, and I don't actually really like, there's lots of things about his approach that feel like I'm in the army or the police force or something.
Oh, what does he say?
Well, he says that you make these agreements about what, you know, the other person wants or needs in order to feel cared for. And then, you know, he talks about his own marriage and he says, I do it whether I want to or not, whether it feels good or not.
Okay. So that is a later stage for me.
Oh, okay.
I'll get there. But the reason I think in the beginning of relationships, you want to spend some time finding out from the other person how they'd like to be taken care of. and try taking care of them so that you can see whether you enjoy doing it or not enough that you're willing to do it so that you don't resent it later.
Yeah. But then how does it work when you're in a kind of a contract where, yeah, that's interesting that you call it a later stage.
So what I would say that if you feel regulated and they feel regulated and you enjoy taking care of them enough that it's easy for you to do it and they enjoy taking care of you enough so that it's easy for them to do it, then you get onto the, are you good traveling companions? And that's where you examine whether your exploration is of interest enough to them that they would be curious and supporting, and is their exploration meaningful enough to you that you would be interested in supporting them in doing it. And then you begin the process of negotiating agreements. And if the agreement is that you provide this care, in a moment where you're exhausted and you don't want to do it and you see that they need it, you still have to do it.
Okay.
But if you don't enjoy doing it, and so you avoid doing it on a regular basis, the relationships won't ever settle. But if you do enjoy it, you know, there's a million things I could think of that I enjoy doing when I have the energy and the mind state to do it. And there are times when I just really don't want to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Yeah, that's very clear.
So that would be something different to them. Once you make an agreement, then you need to open the topic and thoroughly explore it to so that each person knows what it is that they're agreeing to. Once you make the agreement, then you've taken on the responsibility of providing that. And you have to do that reliably, even if you're in that moment not wanting to do it. That's different than taking on something that you really don't want to do. Most of the time, you just don't do it. That's what happens. And then the other person feels that you're not caring for them, or you resent doing it, and the anger poisons the relationship. But you'll know that you've made a good deal if everything settles and each of you are doing the thing that you've agreed to, and you'll know that it's a bad deal if one person stops doing it and the topic arises again. One of the things that you have to pay attention to in this, that if you make bad negotiations, and the reason that people make bad negotiations is usually because one person threatens the relationship. Understand that everybody folds in the face of abandonment terror. Nobody really stands up to that in the moment. But later, when they collect themselves and they see that the deal is unfair, that it's not mutual, it's not collaborative, they won't keep the deal, and then you'll have to renegotiate it. That consumes a ton of energy. But at a certain point, the disappointment that you can't come to agreement is the thing that topples the relationship over. So you don't want to threaten or bully somebody into accepting terms that they won't be able to live with, because they won't. And then if you keep doing that, they'll lose a belief that it's possible in that relationship, and the relationship will fail. So you open the topic and you use your creativity, your collaboration to find a solution that both people can live with, both people can commit to doing long term. And then it settles.
Question?
Yeah.
Do you, in your understanding, is the abandonment terror at the core of all the insecure attachment disturbances?
Yeah.
What about that other polarity that is sometimes brought in, the terror of engulfment or whatever you want to call it?
It's still, in some sense, abandonment terror at the core of it. Who's getting abandoned? I have to abandon myself in order to accommodate you. That's the engulfing terror. You're going to abandon me. That is the other. And there, you know, also dismissing people, for instance, are frightened of being engulfed.
Yeah.
There's a deep anger in dismissing people that they weren't taken care of. And so for you to ask them to take care of you is fundamentally unfair. Nobody took care of them. Why should they have to take care of anybody? It's a fundamental understanding of fairness. It's a distortion, but that's what's there. They're not wrong. They weren't taken care of. So to open that topic and to understand that they get a benefit from taking care of other people. That is to say, if they're good at taking care of somebody else, then they have somebody who's good at, will be capable of taking care of them in a reliable way.
The collaborative insight.
There is a way to see that unfolding. In the beginning, of course, the common difficulty in the way that we formulate this is that if you have the capacity to do something, this is the Dunning-Kruger has an effect. You may have heard of it. One aspect of the Dunning-Kruger effect is that you assume because you can do something, everybody can do it. That's one of the fundamental distortions that we have. The other parts of it are, you know so little about the topic, you don't know what you don't know. And you know so little about the topic that you don't know what can go wrong in terms of your management of it. But the one that I think a lot of people do without actually noticing it is that you just assume because it's easy for you to do something that anybody else should be able to do it. And then when they're not able to do it, you think that they're intentionally not doing it, because who couldn't do that? That's so simple. That's so basic. But when you're talking about collaborative relationships, preoccupied people are dismissing people can't do collaborative relationships. They have no experience of it. It doesn't even occur to them that there could be something like that. They have to learn it. They have to be taught it through a collaborative experience. Of course, for dismissing people, as soon as they see that it's so valuable to have that, they want to learn it right away, and they can take it up pretty quickly. But preoccupied people don't explore very well, so they don't have a way of evaluating the usefulness of it, and so it's much harder for them to begin to adapt a truly collaborative experience. And because pretend mode is their most common way of being in the world, they pretend they're doing it, but they're not really doing it. They don't actually have the experience of the value of it. So that's it. What do you say? Do you want to do some meditation? What would you like to do? Insight or heart practice? All right, let go of the meditation. Totally swept up in thinking the whole time. Dorme, as the French would say. Good.
I can say that I wish my concentration was stronger at this point.
Yeah. So just more breath counting, more metajana.
Yeah, when I was meditating more, it was stronger.
Yeah.
And I noticed it's almost like, do you think it's like a muscle that you have to use a lot?
I think it also is dependent on conditions. It is late and it's the end of the day. Everybody's concentration is likely diminished by that. Mm. And it also depends on when your bright cycle is. Is it in the morning, the midday? Is it afternoon? Is it in the evening? All of those things affect it. So you pump it up. It's different than a muscle in the sense that you pump it up and develop the capacity for it, but then it's completely subject to the conditions of the present moment. It can be completely there and completely not there. We're in the middle of a level one, which is on Saturday morning. This Saturday is the second class out of four. So if you're interested in more about the attachment stuff, come to that. We're going to talk about the characteristics or the skill set of secure attachment and more about emotional regulation. We have a level two coming up in September. If you're interested in a deeper dive into the attachment stuff, take a look at that. I think that's mainly what's coming up right away. It's up on the website. Take a look.
Isn't level two class whatever tomorrow morning?
Yes, if you're currently enrolled in a level two, then that class will meet tomorrow. But we're going to start another one in October. And we are offering a class called How to Give the Adult Attachment Interview if you're interested in that as well. It's on a Saturday in September, I think. That's coming up. So take a look at all of that. It's all up on the website. I offer the teaching freely, but I do hope that if you're able to make a donation, you will. There's a link on the website to do that. Any amount is appreciated. It helps support me and also the work that I'm doing through Metta Group. So take a look at that. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your practice. And I hope to see you soon. Bye now.